Hello, everyone. Welcome to another Newsmakers podcast. This is Kyle Gargaro, editorial director of the ACHR News. Today, we have a friend of the news joining us as a guest. St. Louis contractor Butch Welsh has been writing for us for, well, geez, as long as I've been on the news, Butch, and now you're returning as a podcast guest. Thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure.
I just want to start off by telling us that you are in the St. Louis market, so I know we're really sweating here in Michigan with the heat, which usually leads to good business. Kind of let us know what's going on in St. Louis.
Yeah, we actually had our first hot weekend last weekend. I have to say that business has been good throughout the spring, even though we didn't really have any hot weather. We've been probably 2 weeks behind on installations, 2 to 3 weeks, which is kind of normal for this time. We have some openings. We always will make openings for no cooling people somehow. We will work service guys till all hours of the evening. The installation crews will take on an extra job when they have to get people back under cooling. So we do what's necessary. But overall, the business is good. We have no complaints from that standpoint. I think one of the things, two things that I read about and hear about throughout the industry, not only here in St. Louis, but in general, number one is manpower, people being able to get manpower, and the other thing is materials and material costs. I'll address them one at a time from our standpoint. Labor in St. Louis is not a problem at all. We are a union company. Pretty much a union town. We have a highly skilled workforce in the heating and air conditioning industry. And quite frankly, we have over 200 applicants on our apprentice waiting list to become sheet metal and service apprentices. And so we really have a very vast group to draw from, and we really have no trouble getting employees from a service technician standpoint, again, because we provide good wages, good benefits, and quite honestly, we're a good company to work for. We have no problem getting employees. If we need somebody, one of our 22 service technicians know somebody at another company who's ready to make a move, and we call on them. And so when I read about all these things around the country, I feel sorry for the guys. I also think a lot of it may be, are you treating your employees right? Are you paying them wages and benefits that will allow them to live as professionals? Because I consider our people in the HVAC business as professionals, and they should be able to live like that. And so my sympathy runs a little thin in that area, because I think that there are things that they could do to make sure. We are a very attractive trade. The opportunities are, endless, I would say. Heating and air conditioning is not going to go away. Most all of us know of people, just had a situation last night, ran into some friend of ours whose son graduated from college in with some kind of a, I don't know, psychology or history degree or something, and he's working at Starbucks, and yeah. Because that's all he could find. Whereas in our trade, the benefits we have are the fact that for an apprentice, his schooling is paid for. He is paid while he's going to school. In 5 years, he gets out with his training with no debt, and at the top of a very high paying, labor wage scale. And so compared to, I think the old days of, you have to go to college in order to be successful. Whereas, quite frankly, I personally always felt that way. But I'm taking a little different approach to it now. I think there are an awful lot of opportunities in fields. And And probably more importantly, there are a lot of individuals who would be happier working with their hands, who are not necessarily thrilled with the idea of, I mean, if somebody would have told me when I started that I would be spending 6 hours a day behind a computer, you know, I'm not sure how thrilled I'd have been to get in the business because, like you mentioned, how you all are, you know, still remote and everything. I mean, I still have probably 4 or 5 Zoom meetings a week, whereas I would have normally met in person. And that kind of bothers me. I'm a people person, and you just don't get the same feeling. In fact, our SMACNA chapter had its first in-person meeting in a year yesterday, and all the 19 board members were there, and it was great to see everybody for a change.
Right. Getting back to the hiring, are most people you bring in coming out of college, like younger graduates, or from other companies, or is it kind of a mix?
Kind of a mix. It's kind of a mix. It's guys that have gone to trade schools. We have a couple of good refrigeration, air conditioning, refrigeration trade schools here. They've gone there. Unfortunately, most of them, they're quite expensive, and they spent a lot of money there. And I think for the most part, they probably haven't gotten dollar for dollar for what they spent. But nevertheless, they've done it. But they do have some education. There's some that have college education. There's some that come from other trades or other occupations. That you know, they've been a waiter or they've been a bartender or something, and don't see a real future in that, and they've run into somebody who's in our trade who's told them about the advantages of it, and they're somebody who wants to work outside, wants to work with their hands and all that, and don't want to stand behind a computer.
Right. And do you feel being a union shop gives you an inside edge, or just the fact that because you're a union shop, the amount you pay and what the benefits are give you the inside track, or is that kind of one and the same?
I think the union part of it is the value to the union is what we provide to the employees, because our employees, we take a unique approach, and we have this discussion with the union apprentice school all the time. When we hire an apprentice, we're not like, there are some companies, especially the commercial companies, who hire an apprentice and their idea is to get inexpensive help with some jobs, and then they may or may not keep the apprentice, and then when they have other jobs they need the apprentice, so they don't need the apprentice. We've never hired like that. We hire employees to be our employees throughout their lifetime, and most of our supervisory people are people that have grown up with our company. They started out as apprentices. They became journeymen. They've moved on to become foremen and are leaders of our company. They are Welch Company people who happen to belong to a union, as opposed to union people who happen to work for Welch Heating and Cooling.
Right. That makes sense. So obviously you need the people, but then you need the products too, right? I know we talked last year about some supply chain issues with COVID in the HVAC industry. Just want to check in with you and see, is that still a case? Is it worse than last year, better than last year? Just kind of give us an update.
Worse than last year.
Oh, really?
Yes. In anticipation of our meeting today, I got with our purchasing guy yesterday and asked him, and last year we had a problem with equipment items with, you know, various air conditioning systems, various furnaces were in short supply, we all felt that was a reaction to the fact that the manufacturers heard the word COVID and for either need or anticipation, shut things down, shut down the manufacturing. And it turned out that not only did the demand not go down, but in fact, the demand went up because people were staying at home and they needed air conditioning and more in their home than they ever did before. this year, we're having problems with everything. When I talked to our purchasing guy yesterday, there's an old saying, don't ask the question if you can't live with the answer. Well, I asked him the question, and I mean, he went through almost every product that we purchase having some issues with it. And he said it's interesting because whereas last year, you know, they were out of furnaces and we had to either wait till those furnaces came in, change models, manufacturers, or do something. Now, the problem is, you know, we'll order the furnace and air conditioner. Well, then the coil will be back ordered and the coil won't be in for 2 weeks. But then in the meantime, the condensate, the PVC condensate drain that we need, we've got the pipe, but we can't get the fittings. The plastic pipe and fittings are short. And he went on and on about almost every part that we buy, at some time or other, there's some shortage in it. And frankly, he does a great job and we have a good rapport with our suppliers and vendors. And we're usually able to work out something, in the way of substitutions, having them contact somebody in some other part of the country, and have it, over fast freighted in. So we have it when we need it for the job. But it sounds like to me, I mean, I don't think he was bucking for a raise, but it sounded like he deserved one from what he's going through. And it doesn't seem to be, getting any better. And of course then, that doesn't even take into account the price of things. Oh, well, I'll give you one example: copper sheets. In addition to HVAC, we do quite a bit of architectural copper sheet metal work on older homes in St. Louis, getting copper sheets. We looked around in St. Louis and just had a heck of a time. And finally, somehow he managed to find a vendor somewhere in the country who was able to ship us a skid of 65 sheets of copper. And after talking around, he found out that we had more copper in stock than any copper supplier in the city of St. Louis. There just was so little availability. And of course, as you know, when supply and demand kicks in, the demand is there and the supply goes down, the price goes up. And of course, the same thing is true with steel. Galvanized steel and all the galvanized steel products that we use have just skyrocketed. They're over double what we were paying. And of course, when you have subdivision work, and fortunately, our company has transitioned over the last, since the big crash in 2007, 2008, we've transitioned to where we're about 60% service and replacement and only 40% new construction, I'm happy to say. But on that 40% new construction, it's very hard to get price increases when you have contracts out with builders. They have contracts out with homeowners. And so you're kind of stuck when the prices jump up the way they have. And we're talking right now about that. I meet once a month with a group of seven companies who supply the home building industry in various things, from fireplaces and insulation, steel, carpet, windows, and every one of them is saying the same thing, that they're having to go in with 5, 8, 10, 15% increases. And surprisingly, the builders are taking it because the lumber companies are giving them even higher increase.
Yeah, they're getting used to it, right? They're getting it with everything.
Yeah.
I know the process is usually, right, around the first of the year here at the news, we'll get a lot of price increases from manufacturer beginning of the year. Contractors kind of, figure it out, budget for themselves for their profit margin, and then make their choice, do it. But is this something now you're going to have to do almost every month or every week? Because I feel like it's moving a lot quicker than a year-by-year basis.
Absolutely. I would say not week by week, but certainly, I mean, we had a in fact, we're having a big argument with one of our manufacturers who gave us an increase on I think May 25th that was in effect June 1st. And even in the replacement business, when we're 2 or 3 weeks out,
You're
we're
committed,
committed.
right? Yeah.
Exactly, we're committed to, and so we've told them, we're going to argue about the equipment that we had sold prior to the te they gave us the increase, and in the future, I mean, I realize they've got their problems too, but they have to understand that the kind of the buck stops with us. The consumer's only going to if the consumer has a contract for a certain amount, you don't make a very happy customer if you go back and say, hey, I've got to increase it $400 or $500 because the manufacturer increased the price. They're not into this on a day-to-day basis like we are and don't understand it.
Right. And then how are you solving the inventory issue? I mean, are you keeping more inventory at your shop, almost like a distributor would?
We are. I look around and I swear I think we have more stuff in inventory than most of our vendors do. That was intentional. Number one, we went back to to our major vendors toward the latter part of last year and said we can't have another year like 2020 from the standpoint of it really causes us problems. When we have a salesman on the out there and he sells a particular furnace, air conditioner, and coil, and then because they've always had it in stock, and then so he makes up the job ticket, we prepare all of our paperwork based on that, and then it comes time to ship it, and we don't have that, and then we have to change all the paperwork. And in some cases, we may have to change the plenum size. They're just, I mean, it's a very expensive and nasty thing for us. And so we said, look, we cannot go through this again. So our two major manufacturer suppliers agreed to bring in larger inventories of equipment of the major stuff that we use. And we, in turn, agreed that we would inventory more than we traditionally do. And one of the things that as a company philosophy, we have not inventoried a great deal of equipment. Manufacturers love to offer you truckload deals in the spring to get you to bring in equipment. And I've always shied away from that for this reason, Kyle, that I never want to be in a position where I get to the end of July or August and I'm got X number of 3.5 ton air conditioners, and I have to tell my guys to go out and sell 3.5 ton air conditioners, and they tend to put in a 3.5 ton air conditioner where it should be a four or it should be a three. I much that's why we pretty much have purchased as we sold it. We're hedging on that slightly in that we have pretty good history on what we're going to sell. We're not bringing in large quantities, but we're bringing in a few extra units of each size that we use a lot, so that we don't get caught when we make a sale.
At least it maybe help. I mean, might help you a little bit in the cost, right? Because you bought something today, you're installing it in a month, and everything's just going up, right?
Exactly. It protects us a little bit there too. We had an interesting thing. One of the manufacturers sent out a note yesterday that on their on the higher end equipment, the manufacturers now are going to this communicating equipment where the thermostat, furnace, and air conditioner communicate back and forth. The air conditioner tells the thermostat where a problem is with the furnace or air conditioner, or the furnace does the same thing, and in a lot of cases, the service tech can get an app and check that out from the app on the thermostat. Well, apparently, the chip manufacturer, the major chip manufacturer for that thermostat, at least for this manufacturer, based in Japan, and apparently they had a major factory fire. And now, despite everything else that's going on, they're telling them they won't be able to get these chips until December. And wow. So they're recommending that we, in the meantime, we put in a basically a standard thermostat that will, you know, provide heating and air conditioning, but will not provide the communicating features that, quite frankly, that we're selling to the customer. And then eventually what's going to happen at our expense in, you know, early next year, probably, when they get these new thermostats, we're going to have to go out and put them on and make sure all the communicating features work, which, you know, is just money out of our pocket, quite frankly.
Well, it's extra cost for you. Plus, you're going to agitate some customers, right? Because they bought something and said, well, in 6 months, you'll get everything. I don't want to get you in trouble here, but are contractors kind of put in the position where maybe, I know a lot of times they have their one distributor and their one manufacturer. At this point, do you have to go to different distributors? Do you have to go to different manufacturers? It's kind of like just every man for himself in this crazy time?
Number one, we have never in all the years I've been in business, we have never been tied in with one manufacturer. Okay. We have always had minimum of two, usually three manufacturers that we deal with. The major, you know, there are, you know, if you really count them, there are maybe six or seven major manufacturers, and we've always been aligned with two or three, and for the last several years, three, so that we're protected against things that happen to fires or weather conditions or something that happened to a manufacturer that we have a backup. And it's kind of interesting because most of the manufacturers have special awards they give their dealers, and we are often not considered for those awards because we don't, do 100% of their equipment. And I laugh that they will give an award to a guy that buys $200,000 worth of equipment, but all $200,000 is from one manufacturer. On the other hand, we'll buy over $1 million worth of equipment from them, but we're also buying that much or more from another manufacturer. Mm-hmm. So we're not in their, you know, we're not considered their top guy. I have never quite figured that out because I don't look at it that way. As far as our people that buy from us, we're happy what they buy from us, and what they buy from somebody else, I'm sorry. And we'd like to do that, but we're just happy what they give us. But
sure.
From a company protection standpoint, I feel it's the only way to go, because over the years, as you know, I've been this actually interesting. We're doing this today on June the 16th, because yesterday, June the 15th, was my 58th anniversary of being in the business.
Was it really? Congratulations.
I started full time in the business June 15th of 1963.
So you started when you were 3 years old?
No, I wasn't born yet. My mom was coming to work with my dad. That's a good way to put it. But all through the years, we've seen various things, strikes, fires, whatever, that have shut factories down. And, it's wonderful to be loyal to one manufacturer, but sometimes they just can't always produce for you the way the way they want to, and a lot of times has nothing to do with them. It's not something they choose to do.
Right. Now, I know, I'm sure just like all, HVAC contractors, once you're the essential business, I know you guys got right to work and put in the COVID protocols. Are you guys in St. Louis out of the woods on that? I know we talked a little bit before we started recording here, but are people still wearing masks out there? Do technicians still have to wear masks inside people's homes, or what's the vibe?
Okay. Well, the way we approach it is this, for our service techs, We asked them. They have eliminated that in St. Louis County, the need to wear masks. We asked that our service techs walk up to the house with their mask on and then leave it up to the customer. Most customers now are saying it's okay to take the mask off. There are some who ask that they keep the mask on. That's becoming fewer and fewer. We are taking the approach at this point that we don't think that anybody's going to complain about the service guy coming up to the door with the mask on, whereas there may be those 5 or 10% that would complain that they came up without it on, and we don't want to, it's interesting because it's all age levels, doesn't seem to be any, particular segment of the population that feels that way. So, you can't just assume because you drive up to X house that person isn't going to care.
How'd you deal with vaccinations? Did you encourage it? Did you require it? Did you incentivize it? Anything around those lines?
We encouraged it. I think we did not, because we're a union shop, and we discussed it with Local 36, our sheet metal union. It is by their nature not in their DNA to require that their people get a vaccine, and so we have not required it. We've strongly encouraged it, and I think what will eventually make it happen for everyone is the fact that as more and more of our customers insist that a technician coming to their home be vaccinated, then those that aren't vaccinated are going to figure out that they're not going to have a job because we can't send them to the on the calls. And I think that's going to require it. It is so opened up here now that, the Walgreens store near us, I just saw yesterday, I picked up something for my wife, and I noticed they have a sign that they're open, their pharmacy is open an extra hour on Friday nights to give walk-in COVID vaccine shots. So it's, if you want to get it now, you can get it. Anybody that's not getting it, it's because they've chosen not to get it. And there are still some people who, don't feel that it's tested enough or whatever. But I think they're going to almost be required to if they're going to want to keep their – and there are things that, you're going to want to do that you're going to have to show your card or you're not going to be able to do it, and that's going to have some effect on it also.
But right now, either maintenance agreements or some service calls, you're getting the question from homeowners request or demand to send a vaccinated service tech out?
Not a lot, but some, yes.
Okay, interesting. And then if this COVID stuff was to happen, this refrigerant transition from R410A would be, on the top of the mind. It is on the top mind of a lot of people. I just want to check in with you because you're usually right on top of this. Are you discussing this with your customers at all, or is that not a conversation you're having because there's not really, we're not quite sure yet?
At this point, we're so uncertain about what's going to happen that we're not really discussing it with our customers. However, we put one of our sales engineers is our in-house expert on the refrigerant transition and keeping track of it. And quite honestly, my biggest concern is that it appears that there are going to be at least two different refrigerants that the manufacturers are siding with. And nothing like that has ever happened before. And I see that as a real, is going to be a real negative for the industry. I think that's going to be, it's going to be confusing. It's going to require, different tanks of refrigerant. It's going to require different, storage. It, it's going to be a real pain in the neck, and we're not even sure if it will just be two. There may be others, and I think if there was ever a time, if there were ever a time when, like I say, there's a few manufacturers that control this industry. I would think that they could get together and understand that it's better for the entire industry if they just.
I lost you for a second there, Butch.
Decide on a particular brand, a type of refrigerant. Unfortunately, it doesn't. There's two manufacturers that have, indicated their preference, and then other manufacturers, we can't get out of them where they're going to go.
Right. I wanted to transition here, if we could, away from HVAC to racing, because it was brought to my attention that you've recently written a book. Is how many consecutive Indianapolis 500s have you attended?
I've attended 74 Indianapolis 500s in a row, and I'm going to advertise a little bit and say that I have written a book. Whoops, upside down.
Flip it around. There you go.
I've written a book. It's called The Indianapolis 500, Memories of a Fan, and it was of my first 73 years of attending the Speedway, and this was my 74th, but I wrote the book, and it came out just before May this year. It was very interesting because, it number one, it gave me a greater appreciation of you and your people, and what you do to put a paper together, formerly weekly and now biweekly. It was about 6 years in the making. It has over 500, believe it or not, it has over 500 pictures, of which these are never published pictures. These are all photos that my family has taken through the years, and I'll proudly say that because of our seating location and the fact that my son is an excellent photographer, he was at his 40th 500 this year. A lot of our pictures are better than some of the published ones of the finishes. And it's not till you put a book together. Do you remember how many finishes have been so that in one shot you get first and second position after 500 miles, which is pretty interesting. And I've had a wonderful experience attending the 500s, and I just thought it would be fun. And quite frankly, I have gotten a lot of interest in the book, and I'm happy about that. And by the way, you have not received your book yet. I did send you one on Friday.
Okay, great. No, I haven't received it yet. Yeah.
Well, yeah, I made the mistake of sending it by USPS rather than UPS, I've had interesting response, good response. My whole thing is, it was a fun thing for me to do to remember back. You will see when you see the book that most of these are, this is not a history of the 500, since my first race in 1948. There are books that give all the statistics and who won and all that. These are some of the things that I've experienced through the years, and I have to give a plug to one of your advertisers and an Indianapolis sponsor, and that's Bryant. Bryant Heating and Air Conditioning started sponsoring a car in 1958, and they are the longest running non-automotive sponsor of a car at the Speedway. They still sponsor a car at the track, and they with their involvement starting back in 58, with us being one of their biggest contractors, we got some real benefits that I might not have gotten otherwise, and that helped add to some of my memories in here. And
So is that how you got hooked into it? I assume it's kind of a family tradition. Did
No,
your dad always went, or?
my dad got me started. He actually went to his first 500 in 1924
Wow.
when he was 11 years old. His dad took him, and he went a couple of years, and then his dad died in 1929, and dad had to take over the business. He actually took it over in August of 29, and then the stock market crashed in October. Dad was
Good
only a
timing.
so dad was only a sophomore in high school, and
Wow.
so he had to quit high school to run the business. Somehow managed to survive through the depression and everything, but and then started back up in 1936, and then he went consecutively from 1936 until 1986. That was his last race. He went to 51 races in a row, and something I'm proud of. One of the things you can do at the Speedway is you can sponsor a lap. There's 200 laps, and you can sponsor a lap. And so our family sponsors lap 51 in memory of Vincent Welch and memory of my dad, because he went to 51 races in a row. And they print that in the program every year, and it kind of gives us a good feeling every year. But then
Yeah.
he took me in 19. We had a small quarter mile dirt track located actually not far from our shop, and about 20, 25 minutes from our house here in St. Louis. Really not near downtown St. Louis compared to things now. It's actually, we have a science center here in St. Louis, and it's on the property where the science center was. Quarter mile dirt track, and they race there every Tuesday night with midgets, midget races. And they started taking me in 1947, and that's really how I got hooked. And the guys that were running the midgets back in those days were the same guys that were running in the Indianapolis 500. So I was seeing names that would eventually become famous to me, and that got me hooked. And from then, as they say, the rest is history. One of the
How'd you get in
things,
last year, Butch?
well, that's interesting, that because there were no fans.
Yeah.
I was my son, I had to get two tickets because I didn't want my son to draw lose his it was going to be his 39th in a row.
Wow.
And we found out the only way to get in was to sponsor a couple of cars.
Okay.
And so we had our logo on one car and one driver's helmet. And one of the interesting things that I take away from last year and have nice photos of was the fact that Connor Daly, who we sponsored, and he put our logo on his helmet right here. And when NBC came on with their qualifying show, they showed 20 seconds of Connor Daly from the in-car camera showing at him at his helmet with our two logos right there on national TVs, which
That's
was
awesome.
really cool.
Yeah.
And then he, in a lesser kind of advertising that we wanted, he had an accident during the race, and when they went to assist him out of the car, they used that same camera to show the medics helping him out, and there was a helmet with the logos again during the race. And then we sponsored one other guy, and they allowed each team was allowed six sponsor tickets, and so we were able to get one each by being a relatively small sponsor. But I wasn't going to miss out on the opportunity. I mean, the day I heard, I can remember it very well. It was August 4th. The race was August 26th, and on August 4th is when they announced no fans, and I immediately went to work calling upon friends and connections that I had. And I will say this, I mean, I know the president of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, and I went to him, and they were very true to their word about no fans. I mean, he said, "Butch, I'm sorry," but he said, "As important as your 73 is to you," he said, "we have some that have 69 and 70 and years in a row, and where would I draw the line?"
Yeah.
And I said, I understand I understand completely. And believe it or not, the history of the thing was they announced no fans on August 4th. But before that, they had announced that they were going to have first 50% and then 25% capacity. And they have 250,000 seats at the Speedway. And they went through, and all the tickets on the main straightaway, all the seats, they went through and had marked that you couldn't sit in these seats in order to provide 25% capacity. And when we were there for the race in the pagoda, looking out at the seats, I had, I could take a picture of our seats and see the ones that they had agreed to give me and the ones that they hadn't that were marked out. So they had marked all the seats on the main straightaway not being occupied. So it was, but it wasn't anything like this year. And this year was very close to being back to normal. There were, they announced 135,000 people, which will make it the largest sporting event in the United States this year, probably, when you figure that there are no football stadiums are that big and the Olympics are not here and they may not allow fans anyway. So I don't know of any sporting event that would be larger. And so it's kind of neat to be part of that. They required masks as you entered the Speedway, and they did not enforce it inside the track when you're at the seats. However, if you had pit or garage credentials, they did require a mask at all times when you were in there, and which was good. That was for the safety of the drivers and the crews and that. One thing that might be of interest to you as a news person or reporter, a year ago when they, you know, there were no fans whatsoever, there was such a ban on anybody going in the garage area or the pits that even the top reporters, including the reporter from the Indianapolis Star, had no access into the garage area. So if he wanted to get an interview with the driver, he had to submit an application to someone and they would bring that driver out of the garage area for him to do an interview with him. So they were, they were doing everything they could to be safe. And in fairness to them, they ended up, none of the drivers, or at least announced any of the crew people, got COVID during the week of preparations and all that. So all their efforts seemed to be worthwhile.
Great. Well, that's some incredible stories. If people want to get the book, where should we send them, Butch?
I think the best thing to do would be to go to our website. We have a website called Memories of the 500, and there it shows how to buy it. It's not expensive. It's $39 plus $7 postage or $15 UPS, and you can pay on PayPal. And anybody that has, quite frankly, I've even had some people who aren't interested in racing. One of the guys that works for us bought one, and he came in Monday and said, and his wife really isn't interested in racing, but she's kind of a sports fan and all that. And he said, I didn't get to read the book over the weekend because my wife took it and couldn't put it down. So that made me good.
Well, if I didn't know you had such a love for HVC contracting, I'd be worried you're going to come take my job.
No, you're very, Kyle, I have to tell you, what happened was, I wanted to go to a publishing company because I had been told that was the best thing to do in publishing a book. The problem was that with these 500 pictures going in there, and you know, when you have certain pictures that need to go in 1967 in certain places in 1967, by the time I would sit there and tell somebody to put this picture in this location in 1967, I could do it myself.
Right.
Sure. I mean, there was no physical. I mean, I suppose there was probably some way of doing it, but I figured by the time I would like do a template or something and show this, that. So It's a self-published book, and frankly, it turned out. I might add. Let me mention one thing too. This cover art is actually artwork. A guy that I've bought a tremendous amount of artwork from. His name is Randy Owens. Is the preeminent IndyCar artist of today, and I've gotten to know Randy. And I guess because I've kept his kids going to school, I think through the years, he allowed me to use his works of art on the cover, and which really, you know, really set it out and make it look special. And he's that helped make it look professional. And I think when somebody reads it, I think they'll think it's a professionally done book and a highly critical publisher will say, you know, you made this mistake and that mistake. And you know what? I've had worse things bounce off of me. When you've been this business with as many thousands of customers you have, you learn to be pretty thick-skinned.
Absolutely, we appreciate you taking the time, Butch, today. Talked about racing and obviously about the HVC industry as well. You always have great insight,
Kyle. It's great, always great to talk to you. You guys do a great job, as I've told you many times, and I want to repeat it on this podcast. I really appreciate the. I'll say unbiased job that you guys do of reporting the news in today's world, to get some down the middle of the road reporting about any issue is a real pleasure. And you guys have managed to do it for it's now 21 years, honestly, that I've been writing for the paper. And quite frankly, if you didn't do it like that, I wouldn't keep writing for the paper, because I don't want to be a spectacular with a spectacular publication, and you guys have done a great job of representing our industry.
Okay, thanks, but really appreciate it.
Okay, take care.
Yep.
Thank you.